One of the first tasks of supervision after the establishment of your contract and recognizing that supervision takes place within a milieu of relationship is to understand that availability is really a cop-out and is not adequate to do supervision. You may be able to do pastoral care that way of your vicar. Often when the men come back, we ask them, well, what kind of supervision did you get and what style was used and how did you get together? And the general reaction we get, at least statistically, is, well, we'd get together every Monday, or if Monday's the day off, every Tuesday, we'd line up the week's work. We'd talk a bit about what we were going to do, who would do what. And then he was always available to me the rest of the week when I needed him. Well, I think this is, you know, this is excellent. We think probably getting together and working out the schedule and working out who's going to do what and having coffee together and then being available. His office was right next to mine anytime I needed to talk to him, et cetera, is all good. But that is not really a learning experience in the sense that we defined it yesterday, nor is it supervision. It's sort of an apprenticeship, on-the-job kind of training. And although I feel that that is a part of vicarage, there's much more to it than that. If supervision is going to be a method of integration of understanding theory, knowledge, and skill. And so that I would like to at least challenge you to think about the possibility in your own schedule and in your own way of recognizing the necessity to schedule a regular, systematic supervisory hour. And it is my own bias, and it is that, my own personal bias, because I really don't know how you can best do it, that ought to be a minimum of an hour and a half per week. And that is an hour and a half a week to do specific kinds of the supervisory process. And some of the things that I'd like to suggest, at least throw up some ideas, and I hope again that we can talk a bit about it in terms of what it means and what it may mean to you. Some of the things that we'd like to suggest you need to bear in mind in doing the supervisory process is that, first of all, it is important for you to discover whether the vicar during this year is developing his powers of observation so that he can formulate his learning in the particular situation in which he finds himself. Very often they come back and they can very clearly tell us what worked at St. Peter's on the square in Omaha. And they can very clearly indicate to us what they discovered worked well in that particular segment of God's vineyard. But when you say to them, why did it work? Why did you do it? What are you going to carry from that to Grass Valley, Kansas? They're not sure. Often, in fact, they sort of resent being asked. They're not sure they want to think about Grass Valley, Kansas to begin with. One of the very real, mundane facts of life that I think I hope you'll bear in mind as you think about the importance, or if you think it's not important, as you think about it and maybe understand it is important, to recognize is that the vicarage is a learning experience, and you as a man enabling learning to happen have to recognize that, 80%, and I think that's a safe figure, of the vicarages are in large congregations with some degree of money in larger areas of the country and in larger cities. And 80% of the first assignments are to small, rural, not too affluent congregations. They're not learning how to pastor on vicarage the type of congregation that they're serving in. Because generally speaking, few of them are going, except those that may go back as an assistant or associate, are going to go back into the same kind of a setting in which they're learning. What is important for them then is to not only learn how to do whatever it is that they can do to survive with you for the year and to please us, but what's crucial for them is to learn how to think through what they're doing and why they do it, and even more important, how they feel about themselves in the doing of it. In other words, to learn how to conceptualize out of their experience and how dismally we provide for that here and out there. Excuse me, I really shouldn't talk about here, St. Louis. I suppose you'd do a better job of it than we. I generally think we fail to teach men and to enable them to conceptualize about their experience. They come out of that classroom and off their fanny, and they really can't conceptualize out of that experience because the classroom to them hasn't been an experience. It's been taking screwing the top of your head off and dumping it in and screwing it back on again. And God help you if you try to think about it, because many of the profs won't. Now, you know, in spite of the fact that you can delude yourself, and permit me to be prejudiced from my point of view, I think even the men in the field can delude themselves once in a while. It isn't just us. In recognizing and in saying we're out there in the real world, we're out there where the action takes place. And action does take place out there. I would suggest we have a little action in our places once in a while too. Different forms of nature maybe, but you know, action is there. Although you can delude yourself into thinking, well, because we're out here where the action is and where the real world is, therefore this guy's going to learn because he's out here with us now where it really happens. He may not learn because he may not really learn why and who. He doesn't learn to conceptualize, so that he cannot tell us what he can take from St. Peter's on the Square to Greenville. They need to ask more, you need to be leading them to ask more why questions. Learn not only how in this place, but why anywhere, so that they could take it to various situations in their life. We need to make the theological process something more than a student of theology going on a theological tour for 12 months of vicarage. They need to do more than read a map. We're pretty good at the seminaries in giving them maps and teaching them how to read it and discovering how to please the prof who's going to give them a grade so that they can get to you. One of the best things you can do for them, I think, is to take that map away from them. Not necessarily thinking of your map of Washington, Carl, but I think there's a parallel there. Because as long as you continue to give them that map and allow them to be theological tourists in your kingdom, you're part of the kingdom. That's what happens when you really don't write it out word for word. The truth seems to emerge. As long as you allow them, you allow them to be a tourist of theology in your vineyard, then they do not have to discover themselves as theologians. And that's what they need to do. It is the task of the church to prepare men to be theologians in their place with their people in God's time. And vicarage is the place you can really help them to see that. We have, permit me to be somewhat biased about this whole thing, we have, I fear, a tendency in our circles today, it's been with us for a long time, a long time, I think, to move away from the germ of what is to me crucially Lutheran. And that is that the pastor is God's theologian to God's people in that part of God's vineyard. And that was one of the things that sort of excited me about becoming a Lutheran. And that was in the 50s. And I soon discovered after joining the church and getting at the seminary that although that is the genius of Lutheran theology in terms of what I consider to be the office of the ministry, even then we'd lost it, because I discovered that when the Missouri Synod couldn't decide whether engagement was tantamount to marriage or not, it was the seminary faculties that were considered to be the theologians. And even they couldn't agree. And since then, they've discovered that we're really not all that smart. So the theologians in the Synod are no longer the faculties, but we now have a commission of something or other, which renders theological decisions for the church. And probably, if it continues, that commission will be considered to be less than theologically adequate. And another group, larger or smaller, depending upon your prejudice, will decide what is or is not theology. And ultimately, it will maybe get back to where it belongs again. In the genius of Lutheran ministry and of Lutheran theological education is that we are in the task of training theologians, and dare you never allow that vicar or allow yourself to perpetuate the heresy of saying, I'm not a theologian, I'm just a parish pastor. Because that's why we're in trouble. Too many of the men in the vineyard are saying just that, and unfortunately, thinking it and believing it. And one of the great experiences that you can give under supervision to these men when they come to you is to help them to recognize that's really what they are all about. Doing God's theology with God's people in God's place, with you. And if you capture that, you, I think, can put in perspective why it's so much more important as you supervise their education to help them to think about what they're doing, and how they do it will work out. Because as Werbrink said with us this morning again, we've got the promise of the Holy Spirit for the asking. We worry about the wrong thing. If you will help them to think theologically, and will help them and will challenge them to do theology with you, we can all relax about how the job gets done. I believe that with every fiber of my being. We worry too much about how the job is done, how the guy will function, how our students will do their thing, how the ministry will get done, because we haven't got enough faith in our theology. And so we have to worry about how, because we don't really trust that we know and will work with God's power of word and sacrament. And you give me a vicar who has learned how to do exegesis, and I'm not going to worry about his exegesis. Now, that's loaded when I say one who's learned how to do it, because that's, of course, where the nitty-gritty is. And that's what the task of supervision is all about. Challenge them to think and to conceptualize, and you're going to be doing a great piece of work with them. You must, I think, then use this in the supervisory process. This means having them think through. It means meeting with them, I would like to think, as I said, an hour to an hour and a half a week for the supervisory process, where, for instance, You challenge them to theologize out of the experiences they're having. It is important to recognize, for instance, that they ought to bring to you critical incidents out of their ministry. A verbatim, for instance, of a call they've made. A summary of their group meeting with the young people or with the ladies' aid. Or, for instance, a summary of a call they had to make where they didn't know what to do. Group meetings that fail, responsibilities not lived up to, persons who needed help, strains of day-to-day routine of the excitement of the ministry of God's people. And that weekly you sit down with these and go through them with them and look at it in the sense of the direction that we gave you. How do they understand themselves in this situation? What theology, what relevant theological theory did they use? Or could they not find? What substantive knowledge did they bring to this? And then how did they do the job? Now, to do this means that it ought to be a two-way street. If they're going to find meaning in going over critical incidents in their ministry with you, I believe it's crucial that you be willing to do the same with them, that it be a two-way learning experience. It just stands to reason that if they're going to expose their learning process to you, that you need to expose your learning process to them. That the critical incidents that are shared are a two-way street. Now, this is a discipline. This is a decided, defined, agreeable, and set routine. All right. Some say, you know, well, by the time we get our job done and we do everything that has to be done and we just meet to get the schedules taken care of and make sure that everything is covered, when do we have time to do this? I understand that. You know, I understand it up here. But I also well understand that there must always be and there always will be what I refer to as a dynamic tension, because I think tensions can be dynamic or creative, between the demands that your situation puts on you to see to it that the work is done and the demands that our situation put on us to challenge you to continue to recognize that you are also in the educative process. Maybe an hour and a half a week is just totally unreasonable for you. I would like to suggest if an hour and a half a week is unreasonable, and I can't judge that for your situation, but if an hour and a half a week is unreasonable, then I'd plead with you to think about an hour and a half every other week. Don't think about a half an hour a week as a substitute for an hour and a half. I personally, it's my own bias, maybe Carl or maybe some rest of you want to chime in on that because I haven't said that per se before, but it's my own personal bias that I would rather see you do it an hour and a half every other week or an hour and a half every third week than a half an hour a week for the supervisory process. Because you can't get this kind of thing done in a half an hour. It just can't. You need the time just to get the dynamic going, just to really feel out what's happening, just to be able to share your guts over what's really happening in this kind of a situation. So that I would prefer, for my own bias, would prefer that you think within the framework of 60 to 90 minutes for a supervisory process, and that time really becomes rather important. And if reasonableness, you feel that once every 2 or 3 weeks is all that you can do for that, then I would encourage you to do it less often, but do it well when you do it. And by well, I'm not talking about quality, because it takes time to do this. I'd like to just sort of bounce off a bit here. I totally agree, you know, it's a Freudian but now. I'm going to say I agree, and then I'm going to say but, and, you know, the thing that's really important is what comes after the but. More ways than one. I in one sense, we can sit back and say, well, I'm not really too good. I keep forgetting that that guy's sitting over there with that thing, and I'm constantly... you got it unplugged, have you?
Yeah.
You know, when they do that in this day and age, I don't know what that means. You know, that could mean anything. When a guy, pastor in parish, you know, says, I can't do verbatims, you know, and if there's a good CP supervisor or accredited chaplain around somewhere, buy into letting him do that. I, you know, on the one hand, agree with that. On the other, I tend to think maybe that you sell yourself short in experience, too, if you know, when you say, well, I can't do it, because you are doing it. You are doing it anyway. Now, from time to time, maybe it's good to sit down with a guy who's doing clinical training as a way of life and has maybe a little sharper skills in that area. But I think you have an obligation to yourself to analyze your calls and your ministry. And I would not want you to totally cop out by calling in the pro all the time. I don't think that's totally disagreeing with you, say, Carl. I think they can do a little. They can do more of it than they sometimes recognize.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to tag onto that would be to both sit with a CPE man for some sessions to get into the style and get into the understanding of what that process is about, and then do it on your own. Challenge yourself, and then maybe even have him critique it once or twice through the year after that.
Yeah.
It's another way of
handling it. That would be a good style. I think, what I'm sort of trying to suggest, the back door of that thing is that probably this young man who's with you for the year is going to be about at the same place in analyzing verbatims that you are. You know, the thing is, no, I don't mean at the same time. I mean, given the same number of years in the ministry, he's going to be more like you, generally, in his ministry than he is like the CV supervisor. And what can be of real benefit to him in analyzing these critical instances is not so much how sharp you are and what tremendous insights you share with him, which you're going to share. Well, that's simply because of your experience. You've got that to bring to it. But one of the underlying benefits that you give him as you go through this, if you can get off worrying about how smarter you are or how impressed you are going to be by him or with him, is that as you begin to analyze and share with him what you see him doing, you begin to share your own self-analysis of what you're doing, you're beginning to show him you. You're beginning to open up to him yourself. And that's probably a more accurate mirror for him to work with in terms of how he's going to view ministry in that kind of place than the pros mirror of him is going to be. And I think both are crucial. So that I just ask you, don't be too concerned about how profound, because it's the experience, it's you in ministry that really need to be shared with. That's really what can become important. Now, as you go through this thing, I think there are a few guidelines in terms of how you analyze that I'd like to share with you, just as some suggestions, and again, you have to find your own style. But as you go through this supervisory process with him and you begin to analyze, or let's say you give him feedback, I think this is maybe a better word for the process, I'd like to suggest that you think about the kind of feedback you give to him. Maybe even think about the kind of feedback you give to your kids. And number one, try to make your feedback as descriptive as it possibly can be. Try to be descriptive rather than evaluative, if you can put those two in perspective. I think the more descriptive you are in your feedback, the more helpful you are. We tend to be, by nature, evaluative in our feedback. But we learn better under supervision. A man will learn better, and that's a value judgment on my part, I grant you, but I believe he will learn better if you will describe your perceptions of what's going on rather than always evaluating what's going on. Because it leaves the vicar free to use the feedback to the extent that he's able to, and it reduces the need to be defensive. You come in and you say to him, you know, you failed last night, or you didn't communicate, or you shouldn't have done this. All of which may be true, but immediately, you know, what does he do with that? I suppose many of you are far better put together than I am, but when a guy comes to me and right off the bat, first thing he says is, you screwed up. I like to think that I'm ready to say, yeah, I guess so. And I suppose at the intellectual level, I am ready to say, yeah, that's right. But down here, I'm not, you know. About 10 minutes after that, I have to excuse myself to go potty, you know. So that if you can share with him in a descriptive way, you know, Jim, what I saw happening last night is that it seems to me, and what I experienced you doing, see, enables him to at least be able to say, well, gee, but that isn't what I, you know, and you can always say, well, that's how I experienced it. And you can talk about it. What you're talking about is your mutual experience then, you see. It's not bolts and cyanide. And then let's face it, you are an authority figure. You're always going to be, regardless of how peerage that relationship may be. You still are also an authority. And to carry that authority with a descriptive process rather than an evaluative process frees up the experience. So at least I'd like you to think in terms of descriptive rather than evaluative process. Secondly, be specific. Try to be specific rather than general. To tell him, for instance, you were very dominating with the young people last night is not as useful as telling him, you know, when Jimmy was talking to you about his plans and what he thought they ought to do, I experienced you as not hearing him. What I heard him trying to say was, or I sort of experienced you not listening because you had another agenda that you wanted. Or you really wanted the young people to do this, and that sort of prevented you from hearing what two or three of the young people were saying. And then say, you know, and then sort of out of that come to a stance of how maybe he dominates. But to simply tell him, this is what you do, although it may be that's what he's doing. But be specific. Don't just tell him what he's doing. Tell him how you experience him doing it so that he's got something to tie it into. Again, that creates less need for defensiveness. Take into consideration his needs as well as your own. When you start getting into the supervisory process, remember sometimes your needs can get in the way. And you can be dealing more with your needs to make sure that he doesn't do that again than his learning experience. So you just might, you know, just at least think about that. Another one, and I'm not real sure I can be what I just asked you to be, specific rather than general with this one, because it's a tough one, but I'd like to give it to you just as a general principle and hope you can find your own way through it. Direct your feedback to behavior that you feel can be corrected. In other words, if you see him doing things, operating out of a stance, a personality trait, a character, well, oh, it's a character disorder. He shouldn't be out there with that, I guess. A behavior pattern that is not correctable, to continue to feedback only increases frustration. The feedback to him about shortcomings that he really has no control over. I say, I'm a little bit... It's a little tough for me to specify that. maybe a high-pitched voice that annoys you and makes him less adequate in the preaching than you feel he could be, because, you know, he, unless you can give him, you know, speech therapy or direct him to somebody who can really work with that, constant feedback about how that's impeding is only going to increase his frustration. And it's just one that comes to the top of my head. But at least, you know, try to, when you start to give him feedback about things he's doing or the way he does things, ask yourself, you know, can he do anything about it? Probably one of the most important things for you to do in the whole process is, as you go through the supervisory process with him, be sure and check for clarity and for accuracy of his perceptions. Check out his perceptions of what he hears you say. You know, you've all been through this. You know what there is. There's what you say, there's what you think you said, there's what he heard, there's what you actually did say. You know all those stages of communication. It's crucial as you go through supervisory process that you continually check with him as to how he is hearing, what his perceptions are of what you're saying. So continue to check this out with him so that you know where he's at. Now, one other thing I'd like to just throw in here, and then see where you're at, is one of the things that really fouls us up in this whole process, particularly in the area of supervision, is how clearly we have worked through for ourselves and how clearly we are ready to work through with other people. Basically, the difference between how we carry out responsibility and how we carry out accountability. I think that as you help this young man to discover ministry and to think and to theologize in his tasks, you must recognize that you are at one and the same time an authority figure and a helping person. I think you can't run from that. You have to help him to understand that you have at least tried to work through the difference between responsibility to and responsibility for. Now, I would like to suggest to you that one of the problems we have, particularly in our circles and in the kind of a system of education that some of us came through, is that we have never really clearly distinguished this difference. And it's my contention that although we read an awful lot about ministerial breakdown and stress and strain in the ministry, most of which is in theory attributed to too much work, to overwork. It's my own personal conviction based on some, I believe, hardcore clinical data that this is a myth. Most of the breakdown of clergy is not because we're so overworked, it's because we haven't really thought through the differences between responsibility two and four. And that leads us to this kind of a thing that we call overwork. I would submit to you that it is theologically and psychologically impossible for anyone to be responsible for anyone else. That it is absolutely impossible. Whether you want to talk about it from a theological or a psychological point of view. And one of the problems that we have, particularly in being educators, and even more basically than that, is our pastoral ministry, is assuming that we can, or especially assuming that God calls upon us to be responsible for another human being. And that's indefensible. And this is what I think enables us, or prevents us, I'm sorry, this is what prevents us from being free enough to allow ministry to happen and to allowing, in the supervisory process, the vicars to grow. You will always remain responsible to him. As you are responsible to God for your ministry. Or if you want, you can scratch it and say you are accountable. I don't care. I think the words are interchangeable at that point. You are responsible to him. You are responsible to God for your ministry. You are responsible to your people to minister. But you are in no way responsible for him. Or I would submit to you, are you ever responsible for your people? One of the problems we have with that, you see, is that's why we are so compulsively driven to succeed. This is why we are so driven to be sure that we have Sunday schools and that they're successful. And why we, for instance, when we have difficulty recruiting Sunday school teachers, come up with all kinds of gimmicks and programs and drives to get Sunday school teachers, is we're not free enough to sit back and say to our people, well, I guess if you don't want a Sunday school, we don't have to have one. And then let them discover whether they want one or not. One of the reasons why we can't do that, of course, is I think because down the street is our brother pastor in our fellow Missouri Synod Church who's got a real go in Sunday school. And what are we going to look like if we don't? Now, well, what's the difference? If you were to have in your ministry, and maybe some of you have, had the kind of experience I had in my parish where one of my elders dropped dead in bed with a harlot. It's a great place to have a heart attack, isn't it? You know, I could do an answer to that, but I'm not about to. It's risky enough as it is. You would soon learn that you are not responsible for the acts of another person. You would have to take a good heart, you know, because your very first reaction to that kind of a thing is, where did I fail? If I had been a better pastor, etc., etc. You know, it's a very simple process, and it gets into our supervision, and it can really get us tied up, but particularly in a vicarage year. And it's important for you to have this concept clear in your mind, because if you don't, it's a lead pipe since many of the people in your congregation are. And they're going to hold you responsible for what he does. And somehow or other you have to work with them to make sure that they recognize you are responsible to them for his ministry, but not responsible for what he does. And this is a crucial thing to get clear. It happens over and over again. You know, we get this every day of our ministry. The guy who comes to you who's not getting along with his wife, who has been having an affair on the side with his secretary, and who says, you know, Pastor, you know my wife, and you know you do. And you probably, from a human point of view, think, you know, I suppose if I were living with her, I might be, you know, tempted to. And again, you know, somewhere along the line you have to say to him, well, Gee, Joe, I can understand that, you know, but after all, you know, your wife isn't the one that caused you to jump in bed with your secretary. You decided to do that. You're responsible for what you did. Sure, you know, Maggie's difficult to live with, she's got all kinds of problems, etc., but you're the guy who chose to respond to her by jumping in bed with your secretary. You had other responses available to you. You have all kinds of responses available. You can respond to that situation in all kinds of ways. She's not responsible for the choice you made. You made that choice. Now, I think this is something you need to help the vicar with. You need to help him with it for two reasons. One, because it's the only way he's going to learn in that setting. Two, it's because it's one of the few places where he's going to get this idea corrected, because our educational system doesn't teach that. We constantly reinforce the crazy idea that the prof is responsible for whether a student learns anything in a classroom or not. We constantly reinforce the idea that the system and the educational process is the one that's responsible. Well, it isn't. It isn't, and they've got to learn that. And they can learn it with you. That's where this can happen. And this can enable you to be a lot freer. Now, if he continues, well, we'll stop at that. Let me stop here and see whether... Yeah?
John, I have a feeling in the last couple of days, I had a feeling going through me. You know, we've been talking about caring and loving. There's a real strong feeling that somewhere along the line we ought to be talking about letting other people love you.
Okay, I'm not sure how to, you know, I like what you said, but I'm not sure how to tie into it at this point.
Well, we talk about caring, we speak caring for other people.
Yeah.
But a great block is that we don't let other people love us.
Oh, yes. Yes, one of the things I wanted to suggest to you that you need to do it, another thing you need to do besides clearing responsibility to and for is helping them to accept acceptance. This is a big problem that many of us, I think a lot of us have. The acceptance of acceptance is very difficult for us. We preach and we teach a great theology of grace, and we live and we work out of a great theology of works. A lot of ministry grows out of the theology of works. We've got to work 15, 16 hours a day to be acceptable. We dare not fail. We can't deal with ourselves as failures. We can't really allow other people to love us. You talk a great deal about, forgiveness. And I'm convinced, at least in my limited experience, that our problem with the doctrine of forgiveness is not so much, and here's where I think we just sort of distorted it a bit, is that we don't have a great deal of trouble in the Missouri Synod with the doctrine of forgiveness of sins. God has forgiven you. We preach and teach that all the time. That's fairly clearly articulated, at least verbally. Our major problem isn't helping people to know, quote, know, unquote, that God forgives them. But our problem is we stop there. We never really, and sometimes we make the next step. We talk about, I forgive you or you forgive me. So we got the God, me, forgiveness thing fairly clear, intellectually at least. And we got the you and me forgiveness thing intellectually clear. But the me forgive me, man, we never get around to that. Well, never is. I shouldn't say never, but the me forgiving me is a dynamic in forgiveness of sin that we do very little with. Somehow or other, we seem to think if we talk about you, me, and God, or you and God, and we talk about you and me, that's all that's important, and we seem to forget that the whole thing stems around me and me, because Christ has said, love your brother as yourself. And until you really come to grips with the me and me, you can't really do the me and you and the me and God. I can't. Now, God can. I'm not saying what God does, it doesn't work. Because fortunately, you know, God's working all the time regardless. But if I haven't got the me and me straightened out, I can't actualize the me and you and the me and God.
fortunately for me, God forgives me anyway, whether I can actualize it or not. But if you've got to help people and help the vicar, you've got to get him where he's at. And that means enabling to love. Yes, sir.
John, we all enjoyed your slip of the tongue with the kingdom business. I'm not so sure, but that in that slip, you really didn't put your tongue on a really delicate spot that I hear coming through so frequently with the use of the word my. My kingdom, my people, my church, my vicar. I submit that this is hogwash. This my business. It's an indication of a real possessiveness type syndrome that I think has really bad implications.
Yeah, I think I just want to say amen to that. I don't think I can say it any better. Yeah.
I think that goes with this insidious thing of the responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm responsible for it, therefore it's mine.
Mm-hmm.
But even more insidious, I think, is then the responsibility for another person's acts is a feeling of responsibility for other people's feelings.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a little more elusive and perhaps less defined in our thinking. You know, intellectually we can say, well, I'm not responsible for what you do. But what plagues at us is I'm responsible for how you feel. And perhaps you could comment to that more
that's
recent thing, which is critical, I think.
That's an excellent point, because I personally agree with you. I think that is much more elusive. The way we get into that is, I recall a few months ago with my oldest son, we were talking, and we were commenting about something that he was doing and something he had done. And I gave him some feedback that was more evaluative than descriptive. I'm much better at dealing with students than I am sons. And his response to me was, you know, you make me angry. And my response to him was, I won't tell you what. Boy Scouts is what I said to him, you know, something like that. I said, no, I said, you know, where you get that business, I make you angry? Well, he says, you make me angry when you talk that way. I said, you know, I said, well, you're the guy that decided to get angry. That's your decision. What's your choice? Oh my gosh, I'm not going to accept that. I will not accept being responsible for you getting angry. Because that was your choice. You can choose to laugh, ridicule, get frustrated. You've got all kinds of choices as to how you can respond to what I said. Anger is one of them. And if I'm wrong, and if your feelings of anger are caused by my sin, then I'll be responsible for my sin. But don't try to make me responsible for you and for your feelings. Nobody is responsible for anybody else's feelings. I may be responsible for offending you, but you don't have to take offense. I will plead and ask for forgiveness for offending you. But you know, you can do the higher thing. You have before you in the Lord Jesus Christ the opportunity to do the better thing, and that is not to take offense. And I will ask God to forgive me for being offensive. Now, that's at least where I see some of that coming in.
Yes, just to play the part of the devil's advocate, what do you do with the passage, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger?
That's my sin. God says to me, do not provoke your children. And I have to deal with the fact that I, as a sinner, may provoke.
This is the part that you just mentioned. You're
yes, sir. I can provoke, and I can be offensive. But if you do something, I'm guilty for provoking you, but you're responsible for what you do. See, my sin is provoking. But you can't stand before it. I mean, it's a very simple theological seventh grade concept. And we think and we teach it all the time. We just don't put it together. You are not going to be able to stand before God on Judgment Day. You know, permit me simplicity. Nobody's going to be able to stand before God on Judgment Day and say, and God say, you're an adulterer, and you're not going to be able to say, but God, it was that wife I was married to. Or there is not one member in your community that's going to be able to stand before God and say, no, I don't believe because Pastor Jones lived three doors down the street from me and he never talked to me about Jesus Christ. It's his fault that I'm not a believer because Pastor Jones never testified to me. You know what God's going to say to that guy, don't you? Yeah. But wait a minute, you've got to look at the other side of that. You have to look at the other side of that. When you stand before God, God is going to say to you, Pastor, did you minister to him? And then you're going to have to deal with your sin. And God's going to deal with that. But Mr. Jones is not going to be able to sneak out because of your sin. God holds him responsible. And that's what we teach our kids in the seventh grade.
John, maybe we better break it at that point. There's a lot more questions.
I thought we had
that's
quarter
a
quarter up.
High level. No, a quarter up.
Oh, boy.
But we can pick it up again this afternoon. There's time on the agenda to, if John is willing to continue in this for a while, we'll get to it this afternoon. Time for coffee break.
Well, I think it ought to be up to them whether they want to continue.
Yeah, okay.